major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. We're taking it to the streets this week to discover what's new in the food truck scene. First, we get the national view from author John T. Edge, whose latest book discusses the growing popularity of the American food truck phenomenon. Then, we go local with Rachel Billow and Nick Huft, food truck operators and community activists in New Orleans and Baton Rouge. And for a sweet treat, we take a ride on the oldest food truck on New Orleans streets, the one and only Roman Candy Wagon. All that and a beloved Creole culinary heritage hero on this week's Louisiana Eats. James Beard Award-winning author John T. Edge is also a regular columnist for the New York Times and director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. His latest, The Truck Food Cookbook, is a delectable whirlwind tour of America's best restaurants on wheels. John T., welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks, Poppy. I'm happy to be here.
So, tell me now, the genesis of this book, as I read it, is kind of Ignatius Riley inspired. So let's talk about the Confederacy of Dunces and your place amongst them.
Sure, I would love to be a Confederate among dunces. And in fact, I tried that about 15 years ago. The first magazine piece I ever wrote was for the Oxford American. And I wasn't a good writer at that point, but I had a good idea, which was, this is about the same time that Jerry Strahan's book, Managing Ignatius, came out. And I thought, well, I've always been fascinated with not only the book Confederacy of Dunces, I've always loved it, but I've always been fascinated with life on the street. Ignatius's life as a paradise vendor. In fact, he was a lucky dog vendor. I've always been fascinated that way. So I want to work the street. I want to be a lucky dog vendor. So I did. I was for three nights leading up to New Year's Eve and leading up to New Year's Day, really. In New Orleans, I worked the street, worked bourbon with a woman named Alice who protected me from all harm. And there was great harm to be had on New Year's Eve in New Orleans. And I gained so much respect for street vendors in that. You know, if you've never pushed a 600-pound weenie up New Orleans and across canal as traffic's coming at you and the weenie's fishtailing, you know, and you got $2,000 in your pockets because you sold a lot of weenies, it's a hell of a life. And that really did inspire me. That book inspired me. That time on the street inspired me. It gave me new respect for food vendors, for street vendors. And a long, involved tale that your listeners don't need to hear, I ended up opening my own hot dog cart named in honor of Confederacy of Dunces. We called it Dunce Dogs. And in our slogan, I'm glad you laughed, you could cry, which is what I did after 9 months. You know, it just didn't work. But our slogan was, think genius, eat dunce.
And you were doing that, of course, right in Oxford, right?
I was doing it in Oxford on the square. We opened this. Andy Harper, who now works with me producing films, Andy and I both had children who were newly born. I just signed a 4-book contract to do this series of books on iconic American foods. Southern Foodways Alliance was spiking, interest in that was spiking, and I opened a weenie stand. Some of what informed that, it's the same thing that informs my interest in writing this truck food cookbook, which is the possibility, the kind of democratic possibilities of food, of street food in America. So I wanted to serve a great natural casing hot dog with pimento cheese slathered on it, and then we had little creme brulee torches mounted in holsters like cowboys. And if you wanted your pimento cheese melted, we could accomplish that by way of the creme brulee torch.
I hope there's movies of this.
Well, then, Fortunately, no. This is before cell phone cameras. But there is, that essay closes the book. And as I retool that essay about working a Lucky Dog cart and about my time with my own dunce life.
Now, this book really is a departure from your usual Southern haunts. We're going all sorts of new places like mm-hmm. Austin, Portland, Seattle, even Madison, Wisconsin. And in these places, the food truck phenomena is so prevalent that it's almost passé.
Well, it's interesting. I was worried about that, the idea that I'm writing about something that's a phenomenon, and at a point at which a book comes out, that phenomenon could pass. And yet what I found going back around touring for this and revisiting cities like Minneapolis, which had a kind of a nascent street food scene when I was there, and now it's blossomed. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I didn't even travel in the book, but now when I went back there a few weeks ago, there's this really great, vital scene with great banh mi vendors and great pork schnitzel vendors and the like. The trend will pass, you know, the kind of hipness will pass. Food Network will quit cranking out shows on food truck races. Thank you, baby Jesus. You know,
yes.
I mean,
amen.
Who cares? But what will happen, what will stay, I think, the permanent revolution will be that I think Americans will embrace the idea of eating good food fast and not having to subsist on fast food when they're lacking in time and want good food.
Well, you also make a really good case for the democratic element of this and the economy mm-hmm. of someone who wants to be in the food business but maybe can't afford the bricks and mortar.
Yeah, it's like, remember that moment in the 1980s when it seemed like every filmmaker who was an auteur, you know, maxed out their credit cards to make their film, and some of them made it. And I think you see the same thing happening now with trucks and carts and the likes, other forms of street food. Somebody who's got $20,000 in some towns like Portland, you can leverage $20,000 to get a place open. And that democratizes the restaurant industry. You know, there's so many people who take literally selling crullers or selling, what do you call the Mexican donuts, the thin, those things.
Mm-hmm. You know, churros.
Churros, exactly, Poppy. This is why you have a food show, and I'm sitting in this chair and you're in that chair. But, you know, you see people peddling churros in the Mission in San Francisco. And my friend Caleb Zegas, who runs a wonderful nonprofit I really admire out there called La Cocina. And La Cocina works to mainstream those informal businesses who are selling food, yes, illegally, but Caleb helps to mainstream them, helps them deal with the health department, helps them deal with commissary. So there's so many people, especially new immigrants, who are kind of making their way, investing in this kind of idea of the American dream, and they're starting with a small food business. And this offers them the possibility of breaking through, of being a part of the economy.
Well, when you talk about that huge breadth of choices and all those delicious things that are being cooked out in the streets, well, right. What about Lower Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi?
Right.
How come it's just not really quite happening here yet?
Well, there's a number of reasons. And throughout the Deep South, it's the case. You know, Atlanta's just starting to pick up. Charlotte wants it bad, you know, because Charlotte's always aspiring to have a great American city. You know, Atlanta's the same way. And part of that great American city is great American street life. To have a great city is to have a great street life. New Orleans has a street life without par. In New Orleans, you know, regulations are the issue, I do believe. I believe that smirk on Miss Poppy's face would indicate that she probably understands that as well. So some cities are regulating it within an inch of its life, and New Orleans with grandfather clauses for who can serve, you know, beyond canal and who cannot. But that, with time, I think, will change. You see so many different cities, whether it's Nashville, Charlotte, Atlanta, struggling with the legislation. And within 6 months to a year, they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And there'll be a kind of dam burst, and out comes all this great food.
I hope so, because you know one of the craziest things is the no seafood clause for New Orleans. Like, how crazy is that?
Wow, I didn't know that. Seafood off of a...
No seafood off of, exactly.
I had a really great ceviche tostada in Birmingham 2 weeks ago, served from a truck in a Texaco parking lot. And that's 5 hours from the good stuff, 5 hours from the water. Can you imagine a ceviche tostada in New Orleans? Can you imagine? I was in Miami. I had these amazing, this guy doing ceviche. And he had these five coolers in the back of a van. And when you order the ceviche, he pulled his beauties out of the ice in the cooler, chopped it to order, tossed in pine nuts and tossed in popcorn. It was just gorgeous.
Well, let's talk about these facilities themselves.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear a comparison from you about the most elaborate cooking rig that you saw.
Sure.
And then I also would like to talk about bike basket pies, because that's kind of sweet.
Yeah. So the most elaborate, you see some corporations kind of co-opting this. They've got the money, they've got the wherewithal, they've got the PR budget to take this trend, co-opt it, and give you a simulacra of honest street food. And there are places, and I'm not saying this is one, but one of the most grandiose I've seen is this place called Maximus Minimus. And Maximus Minimus is this kind of stainless steel pig that scoots about Seattle. I mean, it looks like the one pig of the apocalypse. Instead of there being three horsemen, it's just one pig, and it's scooting around town. And they serve like a roasted pork sandwich. And it's just this beautiful vehicle. And that took some deep pockets to pull that off. And there are a number of places that trick out their trucks. And that's part of the shtick, because we're talking about street food. We're also talking about street theater, too. What sells? But to your second point, Natalie Glazer, this woman from San Francisco, Bike Basket Pies. I mean, she lived in the Mission, and she ordered a pie from her by way of Twitter, and she'd peddle over. And you know, it was very low impact, really great shaker lemon pies, recipes in the book for shaker lemon pie. But if you think about this idea of eco-consciousness, she's living and breathing it. She's taking windfall fruit in her neighborhood, and she's slicing it up. She's making a pie, and she's delivering it by way of bicycle. Kind of beautiful.
Some vendor, I understand, in uptown New Orleans who's pedaling around on a bike tossing salads. Now, that is radical for New Orleans, isn't it?
Wow, that's beautiful. I mean, like you could imagine like a salad spinner mounted on the back of the bike. It would be driven by the pedals.
That's street theater for
you.
Okay, John, I got to talk to you about this gauntlet that you threw down in the book.
What did I say?
Well, we got to talk about Trey Corkin of the Swamp Shack in Portland. And you claim that they make better crawfish pies there than you've eaten in Louisiana. So would you qualify those daring words, sir?
One, I'll stand behind that. But two, I don't think I said better crawfish pies than in Louisiana. I didn't defame the entire state of Louisiana as you would have me do.
Okay.
I do believe I said that his pies are as good or better than just about anything I've had in Louisiana, and they are.
Well, I was really impressed because you threw in the Creole cream cheese.
He makes his own. Here's a kid from Louisiana. I think Louisiana was too much with him. He's one of those people that needed to go west, and he did. And before he went west, he worked the line at Galatoire's for a while. Kid's got cooking chops, and if you walk up to his corner place in one of the pods in downtown Portland, like me, you would be dubious. You see Spanish moss hung there, and it's called the Swamp Shack, and you're thinking, I don't buy this. And then you lean in, and you're talking to Trey, and there's a Saturn bar calendar on the back wall. What he's showing me, you know, some respect for his place. And then you begin talking to Trey, and you talk to him about what he does, and you realize that he makes his own Creole cream cheese, which he folds into the filling. And he only uses Louisiana crawfish. I mean, he cares. And he makes a beautiful crawfish pie. I served some to some of your compatriots, some of your Louisiana people this morning. People are like, damn, this is good.
Yeah.
I was talking to a very nice lady who said, yeah, we were using a different recipe for our Natchitoches meat pies. We're going to start using this guy's pie.
Okay.
So, it's good stuff.
Portland has a lot to teach us.
Yeah.
Describe for people who've never seen it. That is sort of the food truck capital of the universe, isn't it?
It is. And there, you know, we use those terms kind of interchangeably, cart, truck, trailer. But in Portland, they're mostly trailers. They look like if you walk up on one of these pods, it looks like a hippie encampment that just never took back off after a dead show. So you'd walked up to one of the pods, and these are in downtown Portland, they're parking lots, and maybe 30 carts to a pod. and you'd have a Vietnamese noodle place next to a really beautiful Bavarian schnitzel place next to, the grilled cheese cheeseburgers, which is one of my favorite goofball things. You take two grilled cheese sandwiches and that becomes your bun. And you put a burger between. You get all that texture, all this in one encampment. And the thing about it is in these pods, they're working on private property. So some of the issues about traveling from place to place, who has a right to sell where, are solved by way of these pods because they're private property. And you deal with the landlord, not as much with the city. Portland has embraced street food to the point where, you know, there are white papers being written in support of them that prove that street food is an important piece of street theater. There's a great book called Cartopia, written by a local woman about kind of the scene there. If you want to go deeper and understand what's going on, that book's great. But Portland really is kind of the Valhalla for street food. It's really vital. It has this kind of loose DIY feel to it. And it is this place of great possibilities. I went to a Burmese cart and a Cambodian cart on my last trip. And then also had a really fantastic roasted duck sandwich on baguette with cranberry relish. And this is all within 2 blocks of each other.
What is the standout, most bizarre thing to eat you found on the street?
Bizarre? I don't know bizarre. Spam musubi? I don't find it that odd, but when I say spam musubi, people laugh, so it must be the odd thing that I ate. But spam musubi is basically a lozenge of spam that's pan-fried, doused with soy sauce, placed atop vinegared rice in the manner of sushi, wrapped with nori, and eaten, you know, in a pop.
Okay, that sounds like it could qualify.
Yeah, well, it's like pork sushi. You know,
anybody who knows you knows that you are a man capable of fine points of research beyond obsession in some other folks. And it seems to me you have got this truck food thing wrapped up. If we hear from the mayor's office, are you available for consulting work?
I would be happy to talk. I would also be happy to send them to what I think is the city that's done the best job of dealing with this. And it's, you mentioned it earlier, Madison, Wisconsin. Madison, Wisconsin has a city employee, and he works with the city to kind of curate the street food and say, you know, because this is a college town, and Madison wants its college students, some of whom come from small towns, they want them to be exposed to the diversity of the world out there. So they curate a street food scene with citizen eaters who go around and check the carts and determine that they're clean, determine the menu is what they're looking for. So if you're going to be aggressive in your regulation, there's some models about how to be both aggressive and progressive.
That's fantastic.
And Madison's the place.
Well, thank you so much for all of this delicious chat. Come back and talk to us again soon.
Happy to, Poppy.
John T. Edge and his latest gustatory ramblings in the Truck Food Cookbook. When we return from a short break, Rachel Billow of La Cocinita and Nick Huft of Curbside share their personal experience as food truck vendors in New Orleans and Baton Rouge. They'll tell us how they're helping organize their fellow food truck entrepreneurs. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Rachel Billow of La Cocinita and Nick Huft of Curbside not only operate their own food truck businesses, but are the organizers and activists behind a burgeoning food truck movement in southern Louisiana. Rachel and Nick, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, first, a bit about each of your businesses. Rachel, La Cocinita is New Orleans-based, right?
Yes. Yeah, we're located here in town. My partner, Benoit Angulo, is a chef from Venezuela, and he's been living in New Orleans for about 12 years now. What he missed most about Venezuela was the late-night street food culture there, and so he was excited to start a food truck here in New Orleans featuring his local cuisine from his hometown.
Give me an example of what we might eat from La Cocinita.
There's Venezuelan cornmeal patties called arepas. We stuff them with your choice of meat and fresh homemade sauces. And we also have plantains and rice and beans and tacos and
yum.
All kinds of goodies.
Yum. So, Nick, you have curbside trucks in Baton Rouge,
I
right?
I sure do, yeah.
And tell me about your business. Tell me your business, Nick.
Started out 5 years ago, actually, kind of out of a need for my personal late-night hunger. From New Orleans, transplanted to LSU for school, walked out of a bar. There was no dough bowl. There was no F&M cheese fries. There was no Camellia Grill, no trolley stop. There was McDonald's and Taco Bell. And so kind of what I gathered from that was I could possibly make some money and feed myself with good food. So that's what we did. 5 years ago, I opened up a trailer outside of a bar in Baton Rouge. And we're here now 5 years later with two trucks roaming the city.
And what do we find on curbside trucks?
Burgers. Burgers done right. The philosophy that I have behind it is if I'm going to take out the chair and the cute hostess and the beer and the air conditioning and all this stuff that makes up a restaurant, I kind of have to give you the best burger that I can give you. And that's kind of the philosophy that we had from the beginning is just scratch made. We grind our own beef. We work with a bakery to get our bread locally. All house made pickles, veggies. You know, everything's kind of Louisiana sourced. And yeah,
The aroma in the air just must be intoxicating when you walk out of that Baton Rouge bar.
Oh yeah.
So, what got you all interested in this kind of a business model?
I would say just my personal need. You know, I kind of grew up in that concession business, you know, working at the playground. My family ran the concession at the playground. So I was always kind of in that quick, short order, you know, kind of atmosphere. Probably the second year of school, I just didn't really want to sit behind a desk. You know, I've always been interested in food, always read a lot as far as books, you know, food books are concerned, and figured I would just take the plunge and see what happens.
And what about you, Rachel?
I'm actually a social worker by training, but when I moved down to New Orleans, I wanted to do, you know, in addition to the social work I was doing, I also wanted to work part-time at a restaurant and kind of explore the culinary scene here. And so I started working at Commander's Palace, which is where I met my partner, Benoit. And we were having drinks late one night after a shift, hungry, and we'd had our help meal at 5 p.m., and this is probably 12:30, 1 in the morning, and there wasn't much to eat. So we started brainstorming about starting a food truck.
Well, take us through a typical day and give us an idea of how much preparation goes into getting ready before you even make your first sale.
We take a couple days off to do, you know, to knock out a lot of our prep work. So day one, we're going to the store and the markets and getting all of our meats and produce and whatnot. And then we're roasting pork for 8-9 hours in the oven and braising the chicken and cooking the beans on the stovetop that whole time. And then, you know, the second day we're working on, you know, using the vegetables that we've roasted. And we usually have like 8 to 10 fresh homemade sauces. And so that's quite a long process making the sauces. And then we work on the garnishes and, you know, kind of having everything ready so that when we're going to be serving, all we have to do is kind of load up the truck and get ready to go, heat up the griddle, and then just start making fresh tacos and arepas and tostones and all that.
So the assembly happens on the truck, but you do a tremendous amount of prep work in a separate prep kitchen somewhere.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And how about you, Nick?
It's pretty much the same thing. We try to prep every other day if we can. The whole philosophy, obviously, behind these trucks is that we have a passion for food. So the fresher I can grind that beef and get it from that griddle to your mouth, the better.
So what's the process of deciding where to set the truck up?
Social media. I mean, for us in Baton Rouge, we've kind of been at it a little longer than the New Orleans scene. And a lot of my locations come from Facebook and Twitter. Where do you want us this week? You know, and that's kind of how we figured out new locations is through social media.
Yeah, it's a lot of we go to some of the regular farmers markets. You know, we park at Hollygrove every Saturday morning, and we park at the Crescent City Market on Thursdays in Mid-City. We just coordinate with bar owners who whose bars don't serve food. And so we have our regular spots, and then we add on special events and catering gigs and all that.
What sort of codes and standards are they? And are they different from one city to the next?
Yes. Well, first off, there's a 100 permit limit. So there are only 100 mobile food vendor permits in New Orleans. And it sometimes sounds like a lot to people because they'll say like, oh, 100 food trucks, that's plenty. But actually, the permits apply towards the fresh produce vendors, snowball stands. And so, you know, when it comes down to it, there are very few permits available. It's very difficult to get a permit. We were lucky enough to get one, but I frequently get calls and emails from people saying, like, I started this truck and then, like, now I'm unable to get a permit. What do I do? And unfortunately, there's not a real good answer for that.
Is there a waiting list or something?
I just found out about a waiting list. I actually met with a couple yesterday that's looking to start a truck, and they were at City Hall recently asking about this whole process. And eventually they got to a point where they learned of a waiting list. The woman held up a 2-page handwritten, you know, list that probably had, you know, 50 to 60 names and phone numbers on it. The permits expire every year on January 31st. And so whoever has a permit has the first opportunity to renew. And so those 100 permits typically recirculate within the same group of mobile food vendors. But I guess theoretically, if any become available, they would call the people on this list in that order.
Theoretically.
yeah, I'm not sure how that whole process works because I'm not even sure that any become available each year. I know that we will always be careful about renewing. I think that because they are so coveted, people are good about hanging on to them and renewing. So
what's the story in Baton Rouge, Nick?
From when I've started, we haven't really had any problems. The organization that we started 2 years ago, the focus was that if there was to be a problem somewhere down the road, that we would organize ourselves. We weren't going to wait for somebody to say, you're not doing this right, or you're doing this wrong, or shame on you. We were going to take the initiative and say, we're taxpaying citizens, we have an occupational license, we go through the health department, we pay sales tax, we pay federal income, city, state, everything that restaurants do, we do. And so kind of, like I said, the philosophy behind it was, let's organize ourselves if in fact something was to come up, and we're fortunate enough that nothing has come up.
Well, are there any bits of this operating procedure that you all have found onerous or unfair or unnecessary?
Well, in New Orleans, I mean, in addition to the permit limit, there's also, you know, we can't operate within 600 feet of a restaurant. We can't be in one spot on any given day for more than 45 minutes.
45 minutes? Well, when you're...
You can't heat up the grill in 45
minutes. Yeah, it takes us at least half an hour to set up. And, you know, Nick was talking earlier about the social media following. We post our locations on Facebook and Twitter, and by the time people see it in their newsfeed and then have a chance to get over to us, that window alone, it's, you know, 45 minutes is pretty short.
Not very helpful, huh,
no.
For new business. What do you think is at the core of this?
The laws in New Orleans have been in place for a very, very long time. And so... Some of it probably has, you know, a lot to do with protecting the restaurant industry, which is really important to our culture here in Louisiana. And now that there's this whole food truck culture and trend across the country, I think things are changing a lot with that. And, you know, my take is that it's a niche within the culinary scene here in New Orleans, and it's a very different thing to go to a food truck and try out some gourmet cuisine on a truck than to sit down at a restaurant and enjoy the amenities that go along with that and, you know, fine dining. And yeah, they're just two different sectors of the industry. And so I think they're probably in place to protect the restaurant industry. But I believe that, you know, we can coexist and both succeed and do well. And I think food trucks in New Orleans could become a tourist draw the same way that our restaurants are.
Well, speaking of that, what's your take on food trucks in other cities? And have there things that you've seen that you envy?
Yeah, we took a business trip to Austin recently. They've got these, you know, food truck lots all over the city. And
food truck lots. Now, what does that mean?
Well, most of their carts are not mobile. You know, the food carts are clustered in different lots. You know, there they pay like a monthly rent to the property owner. And, you know, people know that, okay, like Monday through Friday, you know, I can go to lunch at any one of these lots and I know pretty much who's going to be there and when they're going to be serving. And if I feel like burgers, like that's great. And, you know, Nick feels like tacos and our other friend feels like Asian food. And you can just, you know, everyone gets
food
to.
Yeah, that's just how I pictured it. It's like a cool, edgy outdoor food court.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. We actually just took our truck on a road trip to Massachusetts and we were stopping at all kinds of food trucks along the way. And it's a really cool scene.
Well, both of you all have your own coalitions. What are the names of your groups in each city?
In Baton Rouge is the Baton Rouge Mobile Food Vendor Association.
And the New Orleans Food Truck Coalition is here in New Orleans.
And so obviously there's a tremendous spirit of cooperation instead of competitiveness among food truck vendors in both of these cities.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So tell us about how you all work together and what's going on within your various groups?
Speaking on behalf of Baton Rouge, these industries are startups. So to be an enemy with your initial startup of an industry, we thought would hurt us more than help us. Between the 10 or 15 trucks that we have in Baton Rouge, separately, we have a following of 5,000 people. But together, we can attract up to 30, 40,000 people. And what we've noticed, too, is that if you group up, you attract more business. Mm-hmm. You know, what we started 2 years ago was a thing called the Wednesday Night Roundup. And it was me, Taco de Paco, taco truck, and a crepe truck. And basically what it was we had the idea of, you know, we were traveling around. We thought we'd get together one night. There ended up being 500-600 people there that first night. Got to a point after the fifth or sixth week that we were doing it that the location we were at, the neighborhood was basically telling us that we couldn't do it anymore because it was like Mardi Gras. There was cars parked everywhere. So we knew we had something there. And that's kind of how it's been from the beginning, is that it's such a startup, especially in New Orleans. The rules are here and there. We don't know what they are. And in Baton Rouge, it's an industry that working together, the sky is the limit.
That's so exciting. So what's the most unusual food truck business that y'all have ever seen?
I just saw picture recently of a food truck in like a space shuttle format, like you know, it's like a truck built to look like a spaceship.
Yeah. I've seen a double decker that people have been able to, you know, eat on the top.
That's
I've
cool.
seen school buses converted. The thing behind these trucks is, like we said earlier, they're food driven, they're passion driven, and to be able to give somebody a dish where they're not in a blue suit, you know, and they're not in a fine dining atmosphere, to be able to give them that dish, though, for $8 tax-free or for $7 tax-free is really opening up a lot of people's eyes to a cuisine that they may never try, you know?
Right. And at the same time, it's a great opportunity for local culinary entrepreneurs to get started. And
absolutely.
I mean, there are so many amazing chefs here in New Orleans who, you know, maybe don't have the startup capital or the nerve to to start a restaurant here. But, I mean, the food truck model is really perfect for that.
Here's your opportunity. Yeah.
So there's no denying that this is a trend. Does it feel like a fad at all?
Absolutely not. We're here to stay.
Cool.
I started 5 years ago. I'm not going anywhere. I eat, sleep, drink food trucks. It's my life. I know every truck from Portland to Miami, and it's only getting bigger.
Well, we're thrilled that you're here and that you're here to stay, and I want to thank you both so
Absolutely.
Much for coming to visit with us, and please stay in touch because we want to know what's going on
we'll
the food
do.
Truck
Certainly.
Scene.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Rachel Billow of La Cocinita and Nick Huft of Curbside, food truck entrepreneurs and organizers.
Why don't we do it in the road? 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 No one will be watching us.
Rouge-based food writer and photographer Frank McMahon savors the cultural connections of Louisiana as he crosses our state with camera,
Notepad, and Appetite. As Louisiana Eats roving reporter Frank sharing with us his latest and greatest food finds. Frank, what are you serving us today?
Well, Poppy, today we're going to talk about the real explosion of traditional Mexican and Latin American cuisine in Baton Rouge. You know, we for a long time had been a desert in that regard, and we'd had our fair share of Tex-Mex type places, but in the past couple of years, we've just seen some amazing spots open up. In particular, La Morineta has opened up on Florida Boulevard, which is a supermercado, for lack of a better term, with an astounding variety of chilies and, you know, wonderful tomatillos, hard-to-find items like cactus leaves, fresh espeyote. They've got a great meat counter that has a lot of items that you wouldn't traditionally find in the average Piggly Wiggly, let's put it that way.
So, Frank, are they actually producing any food there?
They are. They've got a little deli there that has a variety of hot and cold items. There's kind of a taco line, really, that has great chopped cilantro, or again, that crema, or those great little like sliced serrano peppers. And they've got a selection of different moles that they make there. So you can get a to-go lunch or dinner that is either like, you know, a more traditional tacos al pastor, or you could get tongue, and then obviously chicken and beef. And the hotline there is great. Ooh. And I won't even pretend to tell you that I know everything that's there, because there were some things that I just sort of pointed and got and loved. You really can't beat it.
So what else is happening in a south of the border way there in Baton Rouge?
Well, oddly enough, also in Florida, there's another great little spot that I've been a fan of for several years named El Poste Dorado, and they've got a little bakery in there, and they also sell, you know, some of the dry goods, whether it's chilies and adobo sauce or that sort of thing. But in my opinion, what they're really great at is their traditional Mexican food. Again, you know, straying away from the Tex-Mex kind of stuff. And they've got chilaquiles that I'm a huge fan of and go there on Saturday mornings often to eat. The chilaquiles are a traditional Mexican hangover cure, and so you don't have to be hungover to eat them, but they're fine in any condition. But it's sort of a mound of soft corn tacos that's covered in fried eggs and salsa verde and cilantro and a little sort of dry crumbled cow's cheese. And it also generally comes with like a side of salsa that is pretty fiery hot for a salsa verde. And then obviously some refried beans on the side as well. But it's a great way to start a Saturday.
Well, Frank, you are making me some hungry. I want to thank you so much for giving us this on-the-spot reporting. Will you let us know what's going on again sometime soon?
Absolutely. There's all kinds of things happening all around Baton Rouge and right across the river in between here and Lafayette. So I'll be happy to keep you all up to speed on what's going on.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Frank McMahon. Don't go anywhere. After the next break, Roman Candyman Ronnie Kottman welcomes us onto his food truck. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero is almost as revered in the art world as in the world of food. Her restaurant contains one of the foremost collections of African-American art privately held anywhere in the United States. In celebration of her 90th year, the New Orleans Museum of Art mounted a special exhibit of paintings that show our hero at work.
It's all paintings of me in the kitchen of all the places. It's paintings of me working and doing things in the kitchen. So,
who did the paintings? Who's the artist?
Gus Blush, a young man named Gus Blush.
Mm-hmm. And how did he get so lucky to come in the kitchen with his paintbrushes?
That's not the lucky part, I think, because everybody comes in my kitchen. So you can come with a paintbrush, you can come with a broom, you can come with anything you want in my kitchen. I don't care. It's my daughters that don't want them. Mother, you got to keep those people out the kitchen now, because some of them, they're going to get burned or they're going to get scalded. You got to play safe and keep them out the kitchen. Oh, come on in the kitchen. You're not going to get anything. But he comes in the kitchen, and he does this whole, Poppy, I look like heck. I do. My rear end look like it's about 5 feet wide. But I don't care. It's me. I say he painted me, even though he could have made me look like Halle Berry or somebody.
In her honor, a special African-American art acquisition fund was inaugurated in her name, which to date has raised over $100,000.
And what I wanted to do is raise a little money for the museum and get more people involved in the museum, Poppy. We have to get more people involved in the arts, because I think that's so important. Art's going to calm you down. They're going to make you feel good. So we need to get more people involved. And if that little show can get people involved, I'm happy.
Congratulations, Leah. You're our Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero of the Week, recognized with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchens. I'm Poppy Tooker. And the inspirational Leah Chase is pure Louisiana Eats.
The ship bell rings, accompanying the sound of mule hooves on the streets of Uptown New Orleans. The Roman Candyman is coming. The mule knows the way up Octavia Street to St. Charles Avenue as Ronnie pulls the shiny strands of taffy. This sight has been a daily occurrence in New Orleans since 1915, when Ronnie Cotman's grandfather, Sam Cortese, began selling taffy candy, a recipe that originated with his grandmother in Sicily. Every bit of the wooden cart is original. From the shiny marble surface that cools the candy, to the big iron hook that holds the sticky mass as it's pulled again and again before being cut into lengths and rolled in wax paper. Ronnie, thank you for letting me ride the wagon with you today.
Oh, you're welcome.
So, where are we going?
Today we're going to ride around the Uptown neighborhood, and I'm going to eventually end up over by Newman School.
So do you have a regular routine?
Not exactly. I just kind of go around the neighborhoods and feel it out and see where I might be able to sell the most candy, and that's where I'm going to work, you know.
So what was your grandfather's routine? He had a regular one, didn't he?
Not a regular routine, but he had, you know, certain routes that he worked, and he covered way more of the city than I do.
From where to where, for instance?
His western boundary was the causeway, and to the east he went across the Industrial Canal into the Ninth Ward and Chalmette, and he worked from the lake all the way across the river to Algiers and Gretna.
He crossed the river?
Yeah, you used to be able to get on a ferry, and in those days they had ramps that were built for horse and wagon, and they had slats on the ramp, so the horses could catch the slats with their feet and they wouldn't slip. And so you could get on a ferry and go wherever you needed to go. Ooh. Hi. We got strawberry, vanilla, or chocolate?
They have one of each.
Sure. $3. Thanks a lot.
So, how did your grandfather become the Roman Candy Man?
Well, my grandfather, his parents came from Sicily. He was a first generation
born here, first generation American. And as a little kid, he was run over by a streetcar when he was about 10 years old and lost both legs. So basically, you know, when he went back to school after the legs healed, they considered him to be a problem at school because he had to be carried around, and he drove a little goat cart to get to and from school, and sometimes the kids used to let the goats run around the school, and they didn't seem to like that too much. It was, goats running through the classrooms wasn't fun, not for the administration anyway. So they kicked him out. He was booted out of school in the third grade, and so he had to do something. So he took the goat cart, put some fruit and vegetables on it, and he went out peddling from the time he was like 12 years old. He was a peddler. Eventually, you know, he got a full-size wagon instead of a goat cart. But his mama used to make this candy. And sometimes she just made it for special events, you know, like Christmas and New Year's and St. Joseph Day and things like that. Anyway, sometimes she'd have candy left over, so he'd just take it with him out on the route. And he sold that, and after a while, people started asking for it. How you doing? We have chocolate, vanilla, or strawberry? One strawberry. There we go. Thanks a lot.
Ronnie, what's this mule's name?
This mule's name is Ada. I've had Ada about 7 or 8 months. And she seems to be real smart, knows the job real well, learning all the time, you know, which is a good sign. Because, you know, sometimes you get mules that don't learn very much or learn for a couple of weeks and then decide that's all I'm learning.
Ronnie, I know you've had a bunch of mules over time. And one of them, if I'm correct, her name was Rose. And she was sort of a special mule, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah. Rose was the smartest animal I've ever been around, of any kind. All you had to do was show Rose how to do something 2 or 3 times, and she had it down pat. That was the end of it, you know, and she was really special.
So she even knew how to parallel park, I think, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, the first time I went downtown with her, you know, we had a spot that was in between two cars, and that was the only place to park down there. So, you know, I pulled up next to the lead car and tilted her in toward that car, which is, you know, not something you normally do. I mean, normally you don't try to get as close to a car as you can. And then I pulled the reins back and backed her up, and we kind of snaked on into the spot. And, you know, and we get in the spot, and she's just kind of looking in all different directions, looking around and thinking, man, that was cool. So, you know, I showed her, I think, one other time. And after that, you could just pull up to a car and just pull on the reins back, and she would just back it right in there. Hi. We got strawberry, vanilla, or chocolate?
I'll take strawberry.
All righty. Thank you very much. Yep.
Ronnie, thank you so much for taking me on this fantastic ride. I have to confess, this has really kind of been a lifelong fantasy for me, a ride on the Roman Candy Wagon.
Well, you're welcome. I know you've been waiting a long time for this.
Ronnie Kottman, Roman Candy Man, from his 95-year-old cart on the streets of Uptown New Orleans.
Who can take a sunrise, sprinkle it with dew? Cover it in chocolate and a miracle or two. The Candyman. The Candyman can. Candyman can. As he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.